In light of the airline tragedy in Ukraine, why is there not a simple list of no-fly zones over world hotspots? An aviation safety expert tells us there is not.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM in New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update. As we've been hearing, U.S. authorities say it was a surface-to-air missile that brought down the Boeing 777 over eastern Ukraine, killing all 298 people aboard. Wire services are reporting that some airlines, but not all, have been diverting flights around this trouble spot since early March. Let's turn to Chris Yates, principal at Yates Consulting, an airline safety and security advisory group who's in Manchester, England. Mr. Yates, thanks for joining us.
You're entirely welcome.
There are a number of world trouble spots involving potentially antsy people with access to munitions or perhaps anti-aircraft missiles. One assumes that airlines get updated information about where and where not to fly.
Airlines do get updated information on where to and where not to fly, of course. But in this instance, it seems as though the eastern part of the Ukraine has fallen by the wayside, the International Civil Aviation Organization most recently giving the airspace above Ukraine a clean bill of health. And for that reason, of course, the airlines have continued to operate throughout that area.
Now, clearly, the investigation into what's happened in Ukraine is in its early hours, but do you see early lessons for flight safety, for perhaps world regulatory authorities in what's happened?
Oh, I think the lesson is very clear, and that is that anybody in their right mind should have a list available of conflict zones, of war zones, of places that are inherently dangerous to fly. And because of that, of course, those areas should be banned from the flight paths until such time as they do become safe.
Aviation safety expert Chris Yates, principal at Yates Consulting, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Given Malaysia Flight 17, given Israeli ground troops going into the Gaza Strip, the world seems a more uncertain place in the last 24 hours. Investors and traders are also feeling this and have been buying U.S. government bonds for some security. With extra demand for 10-year treasuries, the yield has fallen sharply to 2.47% this morning. This week, our series, We Used to Be China, is looking at what China could learn from America's experience fighting air pollution. For one thing, the U.S. did the research on the cause and effects of pollution, like smog and acid rain. And there was what was once seen as a successful regulatory strategy to deal with some of this, what's called cap and trade. Dan Bobkoff has the story.
Cap and trade was an idea nearly everyone could get behind. Democrats and environmentalists liked that it could slash pollution. Republicans liked that it used market forces and gave industry choices. Harvard professor Robert Staven studies emissions trading programs.
What had been for decades a bipartisan issue had evolved into what is now a highly polarized partisan issue.
The 1990 Clean Air Act was championed by both President George H.W. Bush and Northeast Democrats. The cap-and-trade program helped cut acid rain causing sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides by more than 70%, faster and more cheaply than planned.
So it was decidedly a success.
But it had one flaw, says Gary Hard of Clean Air Markets.
Congress never put a provision in there to make changes to the program in the future.
And by the 2000s, the bipartisanship was gone. Democrats killed Republican acid rain proposals because the bills didn't do what they wanted about climate change. Democrats tried to apply cap and trade to carbon dioxide, which Staven says led a new breed of Republicans to turn on their own idea.
Because it was the mechanism that was on the table.
They called it cap and tax. Meanwhile, the public became skeptical of markets after the financial crisis. With no help from Congress, Presidents Bush and Obama started trying to change the acid rain rules through regulation. Hart says that caused more damage.
When the government comes in and changes the program sort of in the middle of the game and sort of changes the rules, it really impacts investors and the players in the market, and it impacts their confidence.
Trading in the acid rain cap and trade program has all but ceased. In the end, regulations for other pollutants like mercury and particulates have had the side effect of reducing acid rain even more. A final blow to one of the most successful examples of using the market to solve an environmental crisis. I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
If you have a smartphone, you may or may not have noted it when an ad pops up. Many people brush them off and keep on with their business. But a study from the Columbia Business School sheds light on what consumers do pay attention to in this booming mobile advertising industry. North Carolina Public Radio's Leonita Inge reports.
Miklos Sarvary directs the media program at Columbia Business School and is the report's co-author. He says if advertisers want mobile users to think twice about their ads, offer up useful items like cars and refrigerators.
So pretty high-ticket items, generally.
That's right. Sarvary says important purchases get more attention than pop-ups for pleasure items like movie tickets and jewelry.
What happens is that when a little ad like that pops up, it kind of makes you think about the decision again.
Jim Davidson is director of research at Bronto Software, which connects retailers with customers on mobile devices.
So, you know, mobile really encompasses a lot of different technologies and a lot of ways that folks shop. And it's really up to marketers to find the best way to have that conversation.
Sarvary's report shows nearly $17 billion was spent on mobile advertising last year, is expected to quadruple by 2017. I'm Leonita Inge for Marketplace.
And I don't know if you've seen these, but it was a first for me last night. I was checking my online bank statement, and there, embedded on a $9.13 charge for a fried chicken lunch, was an ad for some restaurant I'd never heard of, right there on the online statement as if it were a debit or check listing. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.